Hello, I would like to welcome you to today's program sponsored by the World Affairs Council of Northern California and the Commonwealth Club of California. My name is William Draper, and I am chairman of the Board of Trustees of the World Affairs Council. Our speaker today is His Excellency Thabo Mbeki, President of South Africa. Born in Idiwa, Transaki in June 1940. He told me earlier to say, just born, tell them I was born on the Cape. He was born in June of 1942, and President Mbeki was brought up in a life of political involvement. Both his parents were teachers and activists. His father, a university graduate, was a leading figure in the activities in the Eastern Cape and of South Africa, of course. Young Thabo Mbeki joined the Youth League at age 14 and quickly became active in student politics. He was elected secretary of the Africa Students Association, and he went on to study economics as a correspondence student with London University. The association collapsed following an arrest of many of its members at a time when political movements were coming under increasingly severe attack. And that was, of course, from the state. At that time, President Mbeki's father was arrested at Rivonia and sentenced to life imprisonment. Young Mbeki left the country in 1962 under the orders of the ANC, and from Tanzania he moved to Britain, where he completed a master's degree in economics at Sussex University in 1966. Remaining active in student politics, he played a prominent role in building the youth and student sections of the ANC in exile. Following his studies, he worked at the London office with the late Oliver Tambo, head of the ANC at that time, and Yosef Dadu, before being sent to the Soviet Union in 1970 for military training. Later that year, he arrived in Lusaka, where he was soon appointed Assistant Secretary of the Revolutionary Council. In 1973-74, he was in Botswana, holding discussions with the Botswana government about opening an ANC office there. In 1975, he was the ANC representative in Swaziland and served as ANC representative to Nigeria until 1978. ANC, again to remind you, is the African National Congress. On his return to Lusaka, he became political secretary in the office of Oliver Tambo, then head of the ANC, and then director of information. And from this position, he played a major role in turning the international media against apartheid. His other role in the 70s was in building the ANC in Swaziland and underground structures inside South Africa. During the 80s, Mbeki rose to head the Department of Information and Publicity and coordinated diplomatic campaigns to involve more white South Africans in anti-apartheid activities. From 1989 to 1994, Thabo Mbeki headed the ANC Department of International Affairs and was a key figure in the ANC's negotiations with the former government of South Africa. Mbeki was handpicked by Nelson Mandela after the April 1994 general election to be the first deputy president of the new government of national unity. A very exciting moment in the world, really. At the 50th conference of the ANC at Mafeking in 1997, Thabo Mbeki was elected as the new president of the African National Congress. And following this, he was elected president of South Africa on June 14th, 1999, and inaugurated as president on the 16th of June in that year. Now, on Monday of this week, I was lucky enough to have breakfast one-on-one with Archbishop Bishop Desmond Tutu, another hero in South Africa's battle against apartheid. We were in New Haven, Connecticut, as he was about to receive an honorary degree from Yale University. I asked him what I should tell the audience, off the record, about President Mbeki when I introduced him. Tell them that he's a hands-on president, he's a hard-working president, he's a good president. Tell them he's a butt-kicking president. And tell them that when he was asked, well, what was it going to be like filling the shoes of Nelson Mandela? He said, I don't want to stand in Nelson's shoes. As much as I love the man, I don't like his taste in shoes. I give you the president of South Africa, Mr. Thabo Mbeki.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much, Mr. Draper, Dr. Duffy. I'm not sure that bishops are allowed to talk about butts. But first of all, let me say thank you very much indeed to the Commonwealth Club and to the World Affairs Council for making it possible for us to be here this morning. And say thank you very much indeed for everybody for coming. We come out of a continent which is, as everybody in the room knows, troubled by many things. The most regular pictures that all of us will see on television are pictures of war, of conflict, of emaciated people who have been turned into refugees, of people dying from AIDS, of people dying from many diseases. And the stories we will hear are stories of corrupt governments, lack of respect for human rights. And you see, in some of the reporting, understandably, as in a journal that as we were traveling through England last week, we saw in a British weekly journal, cover which said, Africa, the hopeless continent. It's very, very encouraging indeed that so many people could come here this morning and the possibility could be created for us to share some of our views. I trust you will understand if we focus in particular on these economic and development questions. Because indeed, even with regard to the conflicts that we see, a good part of those conflicts derives from a struggle for scarce resources. The positions that have been taken, for instance, by the United Nations with regard to what are called dirty diamonds, the contribution of diamonds to these conflicts on the continent, reflects part of this problem. A person that I knew in Lusaka many years ago, Zambia, Michael Edwards, has written a book called Future Positive. And I think it captures the essence of the dilemmas of the current economic relations between rich and poor countries in this book, where the process of globalization has brought benefits to mainly developed countries in the north, while the developing countries of the south are still struggling to survive within this integrated and integrating world economy. And it says that over the last 50 years, the record of international cooperation has been disappointing. It has failed to get to grips with the fundamental challenges of our times, the reshaping of global capitalism to spread the benefit of economic growth more evenly across societies, reduce its social and environmental costs, and achieve a basic level of security for everyone. I'm certain that most of us agree that the process of globalization has indeed brought about many possibilities for rapid advance of all humanity, for poor and underdeveloped countries to take advantage of this process, to take what might be a quantum leap and close the huge technological and economic gap. I'm also certain that few among us would disagree when we are said that a global society presents us with opportunities to collapse both time and space so that a village worker in Uganda could perform some of the most difficult medical procedures with the assistance of a surgeon sitting in her office in San Francisco. You will see, Mr. Draper, that I say a surgeon sitting in her office. You know that this represents gender sensitivity in the office of the president. And to be able to do this, it requires of the people in the poor countries such as Uganda to have access to education, to satellite technology, for the doctor and nurse in Uganda to be up to speed with the latest telemedicine technology. It further requires that Uganda itself must be able to develop generally sufficient capacity in order to benefit from this technological revolution. In other words, the world, and particularly the developing countries, have an opportunity to advance faster than would have been the case previously. The tragic and unfortunate irony is that developing countries continue to be spectators in the globalization process, a process that's undoubtedly irreversible. But to be spectators leads, I think, to devastating results for the millions of people of such countries. And therefore, I think we must all of us agree that this marginalization of poor and developing countries needs an urgent and comprehensive response. And noting this continuing marginalization of the developing countries, despite the huge possibilities offered by globalization in the fight against poverty, James Wolfensohn, the president of the World Bank, speaking in Bangkok earlier this year, said in sub-Saharan Africa, the number of people living below a dollar a day level has grown, and the prospects for future reduction in the numbers of those living in poverty do not look bright. And he said that recent World Bank estimates, based on a business-as-usual scenario of continuing slow growth and recurring crisis, show that by the year 2008, the same number of people may still be living on under a dollar a day. And he said that, in fact, the numbers would rise in sub-Saharan Africa by nearly 40 million people. And he concludes that these figures call into question the ways in which the world has been doing development. Poverty remains intractable despite economic growth in many countries. The negative outcome of this global economy is aptly described also by Michael Edwards, who says that during the 1990s, workers in South Wales celebrated the benefits of large-scale inward investment in manufacturing industry, especially from East Asia. And late in 1997, the celebrations in South Wales were cut short, providing a useful reminder that globalization carries risks as well as opportunities. The South Wales problem, itself an unfortunate consequence of the stock market and banking collapses that swept the East Asian economies, is one of the many illustrations of this increasingly interconnected world of cause and effect, where problems in one country have an adverse effect on other countries. Happily, the United States is currently experiencing one of its longest economic growth periods in many years. Thanks to your ingenuity as Americans, the enterprise, the hard work, the impact of technology. This happens at the same time as we witness significant improvements in the global economy and forecasts for continued growth, which are positive. At the same time, we note that its impressive economic performance has not yet resonated in the developing countries, as hopefully it should have. Indeed, the many problems and conflicts that characterize some of the developing countries impact negatively on the processes that are essential for these countries to join the current economic progress. However, notwithstanding some specific problems in some developing countries, and especially African countries, there are many among us, many among those countries, that have and continue to have stability and are at peace with themselves, countries that have responded positively, even under very difficult circumstances, to the prescriptions of both the prospective investors as well as the multilateral organizations. Many of these countries have created the necessary climate conducive to investment, for example, by liberalizing their trade, privatizing state-owned enterprises, reforming their tax systems, and generally adhering to the prescribed injunctions, all done in an attempt to attract the necessary investments. The response from the developed countries to these attempts by especially many African countries to stay within the confines of the rules has been in many instances to treat the African continent as one country, and therefore to punish a country on one end of the continent for the deeds of another at the other end. Many Africans in this room would confirm that you would meet somebody in this country and says, if I come from South Africa, they say I've got a good friend of mine in Rabat in Morocco, Abdallah, have you ever met him? In our own country, we've been assured that our economic fundamentals are correct and sound. We've developed a stable and effective financial and fiscal system. We've reduced tariffs to levels that are comparable to the advanced industrial countries. We've reformed agriculture to make it the least subsidized of all the major agricultural trading nations. We've restructured our public sector through privatization, are continuing with that process, through privatization, acquisition of strategic partners, and deregulation. We have an equitable and sophisticated system of labor relations, some controversies about that, but a labor relations system that is continually adjusting to new developments. And as a country, we play an active role in all multilateral agencies in the world. And yet, despite all of this, the flow of investment into South Africa has not met our expectations, while the levels of poverty and unemployment remain high. And part of the reason for this, we think, is the failure to restructure the global economy so that it also benefits developing countries and addresses the concerns repeatedly raised by developing countries. In the same Bangkok speech that we have referred to, Jim Wolfensohn also states that in order to have a balanced and inclusive world trade system, we need to pay special attention to developing countries' current problems with the design and implementation of the rules of the game in international trade. He continues by saying that developing country membership of the WTO has risen rapidly in recent years. 110 of them are now members. But membership does not equate with influence. Many developing countries have limited or non-existent representation in Geneva, the seat of the WTO. And where the rules have already been set, for example, in the case of customs valuation procedures, they have often been based on developed country models, which can be inappropriate and prohibitively expensive for poor countries. In fact, he says, many WTO signatories have been unable to comply with the agreements negotiated under the Uruguay Round. Therefore, not only are developing countries disadvantaged by lack of capital flows, but also by rules and regulations that make the world trading system unbalanced and biased against the very countries that need a fair trading system so that these countries, which represent the majority of humanity, benefit from the international rules of trade. We believe that we need to create a situation where developing countries are themselves part of the rules-making process, and that the rules take cognizance of the specific realities of the developing countries, rather than approach the rules from a one-size-fits-all perspective. And therefore, we agree with Mr. Wolfensohn that we should ensure that the implementation of these rules does not place unreasonable financial and technical burdens on developing and poor countries. There can be little doubt that in this century there is a fundamental need to ensure that we overcome the challenge of development and eliminate poverty. However, to do this requires that we ensure a massive resource transfer into the developing countries. At present, there is no concerted and coordinated attempt to deal with this problem. The result is that more and more developing countries slide even further into poverty. I must say, Mr. Draper, that we had the good fortune just now in Washington to discuss precisely this question with President Clinton, who himself is interested that we must take some decisive steps indeed to address this problem of underdevelopment and poverty in the world. It is also the case that the developing countries must take responsibility for their own development. However, they can only do this successfully if the barriers to any real accumulation and growth that now stand in their way are dealt with. And some of these areas are the need for more and better managed development assistance so as to deal with the basic needs that will have to precede any form of development in certain areas. Clearly, there's an urgent need to facilitate flows of foreign direct investment into the developing countries, something that requires a complete structural change in the current conditions. We need reforms in the developing countries that will support investment, but there also have to be major reforms in the way in which decisions are made about development. On the African continent, certainly we are faced with the urgent need of the reduction of debt and the cancellation of debt in some cases. Without this, there will be no development in most of the developing and poor countries, because indeed you end up with a rather absurd situation that poor countries end up being net exporters of capital. The world trade system will have to be adjusted within the framework clearly of the WTO so as to eliminate imbalances against the interests of the developing countries. And this would have to be achieved through a broad-based and balanced development round in the WTO as soon as possible. And given the deterioration of the social infrastructure in many developing countries that has often resulted from the structural adjustment programs, the need to rebuild that infrastructure is also vital. Many essential microeconomic reforms that have to be made in regions, in communities, and sectors to combat poverty and to generate development cannot be carried out because of the basic constraints caused by this imbalance in the structure and governance of the world economy. At present, the political and economic power of the developed countries means they continue production even in products that are more competitively produced in the poorer developing countries. Since our arrival in the United States on Sunday, our belief in the possibility of success in addressing all of these challenges has been strengthened by the fact that there is a very close and important working relationship between our countries as well as between our peoples. Our economic links have also been growing, and I hope that our visit and interaction with the different sections of the American society, including yourselves here in San Francisco, will further enhance and consolidate these hopefully mutually important ties. Currently, two-way trade between our two countries is worth about $5 billion, having risen from $3 billion in 1995. In the period from 1994 to 1999, the United States contributed the largest inflow of foreign investment into South Africa, totaling some $3 billion. And sometimes there's a tendency to think of our visits as always being something new, where we have to convince one another that this relationship has to continue. But I believe this relationship is so firm that we don't need to be raising this matter. The relationship will continue. And what I believe we need to be talking about is its intensity and its quality. The size of our own economy, ranking in the top 30 in the world, and the largest on the African continent, has given it a prominence, some prominence, for many decades. In addition, its mineral wealth is unsurpassed and its industrial capacity considerable. But in 1994, it was one of the many overly protected and inefficient developing economies that were almost entirely dependent on the vagaries of the world's primary product markets. In the year 2000, the situation is significantly different. South African economy is emerging as a very competitive manufacturing economy. We are moving towards a fully free trade agreement with the European Union economies. We are about ourselves to conclude negotiations for a free trade agreement with the 13 other member countries of the Southern African Development Community. We've started negotiations with Brazil and Nigeria as precursors between links between Southern Africa and Mercosur and Southern Africa and West Africa through ECOWAS. We've also concluded a trade and investment framework agreement with the United States of America, and that TIFA will no doubt develop in time into further liberalization between our economies. I think that by any measure, these are signs of a confident and dynamic economy. And the reasons for this confidence are the results of hard and consistent work to reform our economy, as well as the excellent relations we've built with both the business and labor constituencies within our own country. But like any other economy, we have our ups and downs. And like all developing countries, we are buffeted by the world markets. But fortunately, we have survived these storms as well as, if not better than most. Our greatest challenge is to improve the lives of our people. The levels of poverty and unemployment are indeed too high. The costs of apartheid have been high, and it is for this reason that we're still a developing country despite the modernity of our economy and of our infrastructure. We've approached this fundamental challenge in a very strategic and considered manner. It was clear that unless we reformed our economy and engaged successfully with the world economy, it would not be possible for us to grow. Accordingly, this was the first task that we embarked upon. This was not an easy choice, as it entailed job losses in uncompetitive sectors. So while we've succeeded in generating many new jobs and better quality jobs, some jobs have been lost in the inefficient sectors. We believe that this process has now largely come to an end. Our task is to generate new jobs in the now new and more efficient sectors. At the same time, we're of course addressing these issues of poverty relief as well as rural development. Our prudent fiscal policies have meant that we can provide extra resources to these needs without taking on additional fiscal risk. The democratic system in our country is an established reality, underwritten by a constitution which strongly protects and advances human rights. Using all the possibilities we have, we're also playing our role together with other African countries, ourselves to contribute to the creation of the situation in which we bring to an end the violent conflicts, the wars, the instability, and denial of human rights that have characterized a large part of our continent. Our success in this regard, as well as in the struggle to end poverty and underdevelopment in our country and continent, will succeed, provided I believe we can count on the kind of support, the support you gave us as we fought together to end the system of apartheid. I think that support, as we continue this new struggle to end poverty, to end underdevelopment, to ensure that the benefits of globalization reach the poor of the world, I'm sure that if we worked together as we worked to end what we thought was a common challenge, the system of apartheid, if we work like that, I think our victory is assured. Thank you very much.
Well, you've heard some wise words from probably the most significant leader in Africa, and certainly the future looks good. When I heard the words and strong argument for privatization, liberalization, I realize he focused on military when he was in the Soviet Union, not economics, thank goodness. The promise is good, and thank you so much, President Mbeki. Once again, we're heartened, and it was a sellout crowd here. Otherwise, we would have had many more from San Francisco to see you. Now it's my pleasure to introduce Dr. Gloria Duffy, who is president of the Commonwealth Club, and she will take the question and answer period, and Gloria, take over.
Thanks to Bill Draper, chair of the World Affairs Council Board. President Mbeki, we have many, many questions from the audience. Would you return to the podium, and we'll start off with the first ones. Not a moment of rest. There are a number of folks in our audience who make reference to the concept of an African Renaissance and want to know whether you see the development of an African Renaissance among the people of African descent, or do you see it as a concept of specific economic and political relations between African countries? Could you characterize for us this concept of an African Renaissance?
Well, essentially what we're saying is that we have to come out of this situation in Africa, the situation I've been talking about, of poverty, of underdevelopment, of absence of democracy, of all of these things, of a lag in technological development, of a growing digital gap. We've got to make sure that the African continent succeeds as well as any other continent, and that we've got a responsibility as Africans to address those matters, not to say somebody else will do those things for us. I think we have a responsibility, among other things, to recapture, to regain confidence in ourselves, to say we can do these things, to say that we reject the notion of a begging bowl, that we want to see ourselves as Africans being equal to any other in the world. And that as Africans, I'm saying that we have to have sufficient confidence in our own capacities to actually take on those challenges. Clearly, we can't succeed working on our own in this increasingly interdependent world. And therefore, the rest of the world is important in this regard. But also the Africans in the diaspora, I believe, are very relevant to this task. Because indeed, I think that the connection between the African-American population, for instance, in this country, and the African continent, if not a physical connection, but a psychological relationship, a historical relationship, is very important, I believe, from many African-Americans that I know, to this continuing struggle in this own country to address the matter of the relatively disadvantaged position of the African-American population in this country. Some of us might have seen a long interview on PBS yesterday with the executive editor of the New York Times, was saying that they've worked at the New York Times on a report which they're about to publish on racism in the United States and how persistent it is. So I'm saying that I think that regeneration of the African continent is also a common task which we share with those Africans in the diaspora, because its success, I believe, would also make an important impact on the struggles which they themselves continue to address these matters of relative disadvantage, of continuing racism, and so on. So it is an African thing, but I think it's a more global thing. And certainly we would want to ensure, for instance, that this enormous capacity that there is among the African-American population in the sciences, in business, and so on, we try and attract some of that to come and make the sort of difference that we need to be made on the African continent. Thanks.
One member of our audience says that he or she has long been discouraged by and disappointed in those who call Africa the hopeless continent. The prevalent view seems to be that capital invested in African nations is lost in a well of corruption and ineptitude. How do you respond to these naysayers, and what can be done by developed nations to help eradicate corruption?
I think one of the problems is indeed this particular challenge of disaggregating the African continent. The African continent is many countries. If we had time, I could take you through all of the countries on the African continent to tell you broadly what is happening in each. I mean, if you take, for instance, one of our immediate neighbors, Botswana, you will never see a report, I'm quite certain, in the media about Botswana. And yet this is one of the big success stories, certainly of Africa and of our region. Botswana has been independent since 1966, achieved very high growth rates, kept government very small and very strict until 5-6 years ago. I know that ministers in Botswana still traveled economy class, but none of that is known on aeroplanes. But a very important success story, very good political management, very good economic management. And I'm saying that there are many of these things that are happening around the continent. If you look at this enormous challenge that the Nigerians face, new Nigerian government under President Obasanjo, and a very, very determined attempt to deal with that issue of corruption. They've cancelled twice licensing process for cellular phones because in both instances they were not sure that the process was clear, and are doing it again for the third time to make sure that there is, in fact, no corruption in the process. I'm saying that one can give many examples of this kind. There is, I think, a determined effort in many, many countries to deal with this issue of corruption, bearing in mind, of course, that where there is a bribe receiver, there's also a briber. and those who are the bribers are the people who've got money. We don't have the money. That's why we receive the bribes. So I think it is important to take this into account, too, that in some instances, your major international corporations will also bribe in order to get a contract or something. It's a matter that I know the developed countries are addressing about how to illegalize bribes. It's something that needs to extend to the African continent. The experience of Africa in the last perhaps 40 years says to my generation that we've lived through some decades of military coups and military governments, which have produced disaster. We lived through a period of one-party states, which produced disaster. We've lived through a period where a ruling elite emerges, monopolizes power, keeps power, in part to make sure that it can put a lot of money in its pockets. And the results are the results we're talking about of poverty, of underdevelopment, notions of a hopeless continent. And having understood that from our own experience, when we say that has to change, part of that change has to address the matter of corruption. And therefore, the last thing let me say about this, we had a bit of a tussle a few weeks ago in a summit meeting of Africa and the European Union, a meeting in Cairo, and we're saying as Africans, the thieves, the African thieves, who have many titles, presidents and things like that, like myself, when they steal the money, they put the money in a Swiss bank. And they put the money in a French bank and a British bank. They don't bank in Africa. And so we're saying to the European Union, when we remove these people from power who are sitting there illegitimately and go through these democratic processes, part of what we've got to do is got to reclaim these resources which they've stolen from the people. Strangely, there was a bit of a tussle about this. The Europeans were saying, well. Well, in the end, fortunately, they agreed. So I think it is a common challenge, but certainly, I think part of the process of renewal of Africa, as recognized by the Africans themselves, is that this corruption issue must be dealt with.
Thank you. A question now about the South African economy in particular. Your government has pursued an economic policy which is sound, fiscal and monetary. However, this seems to be at the expense of public spending for historically disadvantaged citizens. Don't you see this as a big risk for social upheaval down the road, 5-10 years from now?
No, we've actually been very careful about that, precisely because we come from that historically disadvantaged community. And I think as South Africans, all of South Africans, black and white, we all of us understand the need to address that challenge, which is a legacy of apartheid. So you will see that as we've been proceeding with this monetary and fiscal and other policies, we have, in terms of the national budget, made sure that there is no reduction in social spending, that we were able to handle this matter on a continuous basis of more expenditure on housing for the poor, electrification, supply of water, rural roads, all of these sorts of things, which would make a positive impact on the lives of the poor. So we have not, in fact, done what the questioner is saying, of an actual reduction of the sorts of resources that would be devoted to addressing these issues. Indeed, what has happened is that you've had a continuous increase as far as those expenditures are concerned.
There are many, many questions related to AIDS. And I suppose the most, the broadest way of putting this question is, could you clarify your position on the cause of AIDS and explain how you hope to address this growing problem?
I'm not sure. I have sometimes wrongly a rather high opinion of myself, quite wrongly. But one of them I've never had is that I'm a scientist. So I wouldn't be. The matter of a cause is something that science has been dealing with for a long time, and scientists continue to be engaged with this particular question. But this I can say, there is a serious problem of AIDS. Serious problem of AIDS in South Africa, serious problem of AIDS in Africa generally, sub-Saharan, which requires a very strong and a very determined response. So what we've done in South Africa is we had thought that, well, like the rest of the world, nothing new, that you needed to conduct and wage a strong campaign of public awareness, focusing on matters of safe sex, use of condoms, those kinds of questions. As a consequence of that, there's really quite a lot of work that's been done. As part of that process, we thought it would be necessary not just to have government only address this matter, but we should build a whole series of partnerships against AIDS, which exists, partnership with business, with the labor unions, with religious communities, with the youth, with the women, and so on, to make sure that everybody actually takes up this campaign wherever they are. We decided also this year that we needed to set aside some dedicated funds in the national budget to address this particular question. That would now be in addition to whatever the government departments, national, provincial, and other government structures would be spending, but to set aside these dedicated funds. We have also contributed funds to work that must go on with regard to the development of a vaccine. That also, government has made that kind of contribution. The Medical Research Council in South Africa is working with other organizations, including U.S. organizations, on this particular question. I'm saying there's a whole range of matters that are being done with regard to this. But because of the scale of the problem, many of us in government tried, without being scientists or anything like this, to understand this challenge as closely as possible. And what indeed has happened is that some of us have had to be reading lots and lots of material on this question, with a view to ensuring that we understand as well as we should, so that we should respond with the necessary vigor, given the scale and the size of the problem. Now, there are some issues that arise which require some answers. And we need these answers so that we can make sure that we wage a more effective campaign, to make sure that we respond in a focused way to the incidence of AIDS. Let me give you an example of one of these problems. In 1985, the New England Journal of Medicine published what I think is the first report on the incidence of HIV in South Africa and Southern Africa. That same report was published later in the South African Medical Journal. And that report said that HIV was not endemic in Southern Africa. That's 85. It went on to say that the incidence of AIDS, of HIV, sorry, the incidence of HIV, what they found, these people, the medical people, scientists, among male gay people. Now that was 85, middle of 85. 5 years later, 6 years later maybe, this had changed radically. Where it was now said, whereas in 1985, HIV was not endemic in this region, 5 years later, the report was that it was. And secondly, whereas in 85, it was said that this would be heterosexually transmitted, 5 years later, it was homosexually transmitted. Now, have I got it the wrong way around? 85, homosexual, 1990, heterosexual. So the question we then asked was, why this change? Because the profile in the United States in 1985 was the same profile as in South Africa in 1985. The profile in the United States has remained substantially the same. There's a growing incidence, looking at the CDC figures, as a growing incidence in the United States of heterosexual transmission. The last report I saw from the CDC, which was up to December 99, was that there was a 10% incidence of heterosexual transmission in the States, and 90% homosexual. So we asked the question, what happened between 85 and 90? Now, the question we believe is important because it would help us to address the focus of our response. Some of the answers I've heard to this is that there is a different strain of HIV in our region of the world, which is why you had this change from 85 to 90, let us say. Fine, if this is the reason, if this is what science says, this is okay. It's good information because then it enables us to respond to the specific manifestation of this condition in our situation. Another scientist has said to me, I must say it is only one scientist, a European scientist has said to me that what he thinks the reason is that there is in fact there are biological factors which affect Africans and don't affect people in North America or Western Europe. Biological factors. But he said this was a hypothesis he was following. Now, it would be very important for us to find out what this is. Because indeed, if there is a different biological set of circumstances affecting Africans, then it would be necessary for us in the intensification of the campaign against AIDS that we take into account those differences. Now, fortunately, we scientists managed to meet in South Africa at the beginning of this month, around the 6th of May, representing different opinions with regard to this debate that's been going on about these issues for 15 years or more. Dissidents and orthodox people and so on, as they are described in the literature, to discuss some of these questions. And one of the decisions they reached was that indeed there were unresolved questions which impact on the kind of work that needs to be done indeed to get on top of the problem. And as a consequence of which they agreed that they would then meet both Orthodox and dissident. They would meet under the auspices of the Centers for Disease Control here, as well as the South African Medical Research Council. They would bring all of the scientists together, indeed, to address these outstanding questions. Now, we look forward to that because we want to make sure that our response is effective, is specific, is focused, and produces results. So I'm saying I hope that that process, which the CDC will become, coordinate, will help us to get to these sorts of points. The other matters that have been raised, of course, about this, which include the matters of the antiretroviral drugs. Now, we have in South Africa the estimate for people who are HIV positive is something like 4 million. The our Minister of Health has had discussions last week with UNAIDS and the WHO in the aftermath of the announcement by the UNAIDS that they had reached agreement with the five pharmaceutical companies to reduce drug prices. And the consequence of that reduction in cost terms, the consequence of that reduction in cost terms would be that we would then have to spend the entirety of the public health drug budget on antiretrovirals only. What do we do? These are real, actual, practical questions that confront us. But as I was saying, I'm told I've now got 25 seconds left. we have to intensify the campaign against AIDS. We've got to get results. We've got to make sure that we understand all of the specifics that pertain to this so that we do indeed achieve the sort of progress that is needed. Unfortunately, it seems that a French professor said to me, professor of medicine and science and so on, he said part of the problem here is that there's a lot and lots of dogma that attaches to this particular area, and it's difficult to deal with it because even scientists said to me, scientists are fixed in particular positions. And to debate real questions becomes difficult. But I think some movement is taking place, and I was very happy that the CDC in this country said, instead of the scientists standing at different ends, let's interact so that indeed we can focus on these outstanding issues.
Mr. President and ladies and gentlemen, we are just about at the end of our program. I'm going to ask one last question and ask for a very brief response, but I'd like to announce that we'd like everyone to remain seated for about 2 minutes after the President leaves. So we'll go to the last question and then adjourn the meeting. Mr. President, I didn't want to close the meeting without asking you this one. Can you please tell us how the Truth and Reconciliation Commission has helped in the healing of the past atrocities and enabled all peoples of South Africa to reach a level of forgiveness and unity in diversity?
Well, a lot of truth has been told about the human rights violations that occurred during this period of conflict. Part of the consequence of that, of course, is that even people who had lost relatives and you didn't know where your relatives were able to recover the bodies, to rebury. It's a very important question for many families, certainly for African families. It's been possible for people who were violators and violated against to meet face to face and to say, well, it did happen, but we are both South African. Let's now commit ourselves to a better future, and that this kind of thing shouldn't happen again. It's created the possibility to make some recompense. It cannot never be satisfactory. Some reparation to people who have suffered from those violations. I think in the end, it's taken us a great step forward to the position where it becomes possible for South Africans clearly not to forget the past, but to forgive the past, and not to be driven on a daily basis by a grievance of what happened before, but to be driven by this common thing that we've spoken to one another openly. We've asked one another for forgiveness. We've admitted the wrongs. And really what is necessary to do now is that we try and build in a way such that this terrible past, it doesn't return. Thanks.
Thank you. Our thanks to His Excellency Thabo Mbeki, President of the Republic of South Africa, for joining us today. We also thank each and every one of you here at the Fairmont Hotel in San Francisco, as well as those joining us on the radio. Now, this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California and the World Affairs Council of Northern California is adjourned.